All right. Welcome back, everybody. Here we are once again. It is the Dom and Colin podcast. I am Colin alongside Dom. Dom, welcome back.
Thank you. I'm not doing too bad. How are you?
Didn't ask, but I'm doing all right.
It was implied, okay?
excited, I guess, is one word to describe how I am to be in here wrapping up the Survivor Edge of Extinction finale and probably the season as a whole for hopefully a long time to come for me. I'm very ready to put this one in the rear view.
I was going to ask for clarification here. Are you excited to just be talking about the season once again because it's all so exciting and interesting? Or are you excited to just have this in the rearview mirror now and not have to think about it ever again?
So I wanted to take a little more time than we have recently done before releasing this, recording and releasing this podcast, just because I had so many different emotions about the way this season ended up going, and even having taken close to 2 weeks at this point, I still am all over the place, as I'm sure will become clear over the course of this podcast. So my game plan is really to just come in here firing, get it all off my chest, and as I said, get this season out of the way from my mind for at least a little while.
Yeah, I'm really in two minds about all of this, not just because my feelings about the finale itself are kind of ambivalent, but also because they weren't kidding when they said this was the most shocking finale of all time. And we made fun of them for that, and we wrote that off as just them desperately trying to inject some kind of excitement into what was surely going to be a Rick Devon's coronation. And it turns out that's not what we got. They actually lived up to their promise there. And yet it was so overshadowed by all of the other news that was coming out, most of which comes from you really cornering the market on the season 40 coverage. So props to you for that there. But somehow, despite this incredible finish to the season and this incredibly controversial finish to the season, it feels like that's not even the main news story anymore.
You are correct. It seems like everyone is very ready to be on to, I guess, season 39 kind of in parentheses before season 40, kind of the main course for what I'm guessing will be an exciting kind of upcoming year as a for Survivor fans. And actually, as you flagged up, I guess a quick plug off the top for anyone who is interested in some season 40 podcasts, we already have a few things up. We did an auction draft with Dominic Abate and good friend of the show, Kaz, going through the season 40, a hypothetical auction draft going through the season 40 cast. That is up on the main feed if you missed that. Also, I recently had a great friend of the podcast, Casual Anna, on the podcast to get her takes from a casual fan perspective, see who she remembered from the season 40 cast. That was a ton of fun. People seem to be really enjoying that one, so do check that out if you missed it. And then also over on the Patreon feed, last week's bonus episode, I did, what kind of draft did I do against AJ Van Gil? Oh, we did a
There have been so many that I know. It's really hard to keep track.
We did a fun draft. I thought I had a lot of fun, and I thought it was a cool concept where we drafted in the form of whoever drafts the first boot from season 40 loses. So it's kind of a backwards draft where you're drafting to avoid the first boot, but that was pretty interesting, I thought. So patreon.com/Dom and Colin if you want to get bonus episodes, because I'm sure plenty more season 40 stuff is going to be coming along the way. But anyway, Dom, let's...
I'll also say that this is a better time than most to sign up, because we're about to decide what commitment we're taking on for our next rewatch series. And I have been tasked with deciding how all of you are going to decide that. So if you want to help me decide how you're going to decide, subscribe now. let me know. And then you can have you can issue your feedback on both stages of that process. But I'm very excited for this offseason, actually. I always love talking about Survivor, but there will be, you know, Survivor South Africa and other things to tide us over on that front during the summer. But then also, now that we have the time, there's a lot of other stuff to be getting into. We're going to pick up some of the documentary episodes again. Those are always a ton of fun. Some of the other one-off episodes for various shows and just non-TV stuff as well. So lots of fun stuff coming down the pipeline. And again, if you have any suggestions for what you want to see there, then by all means let us know, because we are always very excited to hear it.
Yeah, we got a suggestion this week, and it was actually something that we had already been tossing around. But Dom, I'm going to issue the formal challenge for this week's bonus episode, and we'll release it at a later date on the main feed. But I challenge you, Dom Harvey, to a season 40 confessional draft, where we will each draft 10 people, and our team total of confessionals over the course of the season will determine the winner.
Okay, sure. I'll have to develop a whole new board for that one, because that could have some interesting angles to it. But
I have so many boards. I was thinking about making a spreadsheet and trying to make sure that I draft all of the cast people in at least one of my drafts, so that no matter who wins, I'm going to win some draft.
Yeah, I'm very excited to correctly understand that someone's going to have a very deep run in the game and end up getting like five confessionals, because you have like Boss and Rob and Tony still there until the final four or something like that.
Mm-hmm. So be on the lookout for that this Saturday over once again, patreon.com/Dom and Colin. All right, let's get into it. Season 38 is in the books, and I think let's just take these talking points as they come up in the finale, and I'm sure plenty will arise along the way. So before we do get into the specifics, one thing I really wanted to make clear at the top of this podcast, I know I've spent or I've opened the last several season in review podcasts talking about how the big brotherification of Survivor could potentially be the downfall of Survivor. And don't worry, plenty on that along the way.
Yeah, I think at this stage we're talking about the Survivorification of Big Brother, right? We're flipping the script entirely now.
We may be. We may be a snake eating its own tail at this point. But the thing I really want to clarify up front, because I am sure I'm going to have some criticisms of the way all of this ended up playing out, is as follows. Good for Chris. I do not, over the course of this podcast, at any point mean to be taking anything away from Chris specifically. I think he did a really good job in the time that he was in the game. I know he's an enormous fan of Survivor, and if anyone is going to win this way, I am extremely happy that it is someone like Chris. And so I just really hope that at no point over however long this runs, that becomes unclear. It is no fault whatsoever with Chris specifically. It is more just the role that Chris played within this season, going on to be the winner of the season, is going to potentially be a different story for me.
And for as much as Chris made up for lost time in those last few days, cramming a month's worth of gameplay into just a few rounds, and he really made his mark on the game. This was Chris's run to the end. It wasn't just anyone's. There is a sense in which Chris was just this stand-in for a concept. He was the avatar for the collective group that was on Edge of Extinction, and really any one of them who came back could have had the same path and would have had the same discussions around them if they'd made their way to the end and won, presumably with roughly the same set of votes. And I think Chris's fairly like low-key, laid-back personality feeds into that as well, where he, you know, if Reem had come back or something in the extreme case, or some of these other people, you would have seen them have a more unique or... Okay, jump on me, what do you want me to say?
I wasn't saying it. You said it.
A more distinct journey of their own to the end here. Chris felt very much like he took the cookie cutter and carved out the usual path and then just put this amazing decoration on it towards the end. So there's this weird thing where you want to give Chris credit for the things that he did in particular to get his way to the end, but then when we talk about Chris's win and the larger issues surrounding it, we're not really talking about Chris anymore, right? We're just talking about the larger Edge of Extinction problem or issue.
Right. And I think over these last 2 minutes or so, we have at least doubled the amount of time we have spent talking about Chris over this entire season.
Yeah, we've spoken about Chris in the past few minutes more than the editors had over his entire run to this point. And that really highlights the issue with this concept that we flagged up even before we saw how it was going to play out. So it's not like they couldn't have seen this coming either. It's that not only did they not give Chris the kind of edit that would make his journey to the end satisfying when it happened, they couldn't do that. There was no way they possibly could have set that up, given the circumstances of how he came back. And you can say, you know, they didn't help themselves by, for instance, knowing that Chris is going to be voted out in the first few episodes and then is not going to appear on the show again, basically, until the finale. You could, while he's in the game, give him some confessionals, give him some screen time, at least make people care that he was voted out, and you can present that as one of the big pre-merge blindsides, right? Nobody is safe. Even this guy who you've already become, you've already come to like and want to see him do well, he just gets cut. That's one of the big moments of the season, and then you move on from there. They didn't even bother to do that. And so I've seen people who were very engaged otherwise with the season, like, still get confused between Chris and Eric towards the end. Or it's like they really did not do anything to make you invested in Chris, as opposed to literally anyone else who could have come back from that island instead.
I believe it is the case that Chris had zero confessionals in the premiere. Do you know if that's true?
I believe that's right. And that is a truly shocking statistic, because
yeah,
you could at least give him one of those cookie cutter, just generic things about the theme of the season, or how exciting it is to be here, or any of those things which someone has to say, so you may as well let Chris say them, knowing what's in store for him. But instead, we just got nothing. And I guess the kind of argument would be, you want there to be some kind of suspense. You don't want to, like, why build up Chris that much just to have him get voted out if he's not going to come back eventually? Because then you'd just be spoiling it. I guess the answer there is Chris bought it himself. First of all, he apparently there was a thing he posted on Instagram of him in the merge buff, which there's really only one way he could have come by that. So he took some of the suspense out of that himself. But also, I think that's just a secondary concern when you decide to embrace this concept. I think it's much better to, for people to have an inkling that Chris might be coming back and rooting for that to happen, versus having no idea who he even is. And then when he comes back, you have no reason to care, even when he goes on this spectacular run down the home stretch.
Yeah, I want to talk about the editing of the season in general terms a little later on. But in this specific case of Chris and the not just winner edit, but just kind of approach by Chris and production this whole season in terms of metagame as well, where not only does Chris get zero confessionals in the premiere, and they can't even give him, as you were saying, some kind of just throwaway confessional to make him at least get some sort of screen time and come across as a decent enough guy. It strikes me, combining that with Chris and the really low profile he kept on social media, other than, I guess, I'm so happy I didn't hear about this until after the season, but posting that picture of himself with the red merge buff on, do you think this was like a conscious effort to super downplay this and try to make it the biggest blindside in history? Because I agree with you, there is something to showing us a little of Chris and giving us a reason to care about him, you know, in the event that he did return, and then when he ultimately does return. But I also actually really do think that 38 seasons into this, I'm not totally opposed to the most under the radar puts it beyond anything we, you know, that doesn't really fit the general under the radar terminology that we use, where someone's on the season but barely in the episodes. Chris is not at all in the episodes, essentially. Was this deliberate, do you think? And was this something that you were okay with, having this just like be this mega UTR winner?
I wouldn't say I'm okay with it, but this, I'm going to give the same answer that I give for all of these Edge of Extinction related questions, which is, I'm not okay with a concept really on a fundamental level, but once you have it in place, why not push the boundary, right? It is like an interesting thought experiment to see, to test the audience's engagement with a show. It's like, if we have this guy who, I would say a good 85% of the casuals out there would not know his name coming into the finale.
Way over. I'm going to say 98% right. of the casuals would not know his name.
I'm being incredibly generous here, just, you know, to strengthen the other side of the case here. But so even going with your figure of 98%, when basically nobody even knows who this guy is, for him to put on this clinic in the final episode and to have recency bias just overwhelm everything else, is that still a satisfying ending for a lot of people? Because I know a lot of the casuals that you see on Facebook and elsewhere were outraged that Rick was, you know, fell at the final hurdle, was deprived of his win. But I don't see too many of them raging about Chris. It feels like they're mad that the guy who had to be built up as a decoy instead didn't end up winning. But there's no real animosity towards Chris, which you'd expect there would be given their general resting level of animosity towards everybody.
I think Chris is a perfect case study in what I have been pleading with them to consider, they being like the editors or producers or whomever is determining these storylines. in the concept of casuals will come around so fast on whatever you throw in front of them. And I brought this up when Gavin's wife came out at the Loved Ones Challenge. I remember presenting the hypothetical of, like, if Gavin were the eventual winner, you could get away with giving him this little screen time up until this point, because as soon as his wife comes out, they're all going to fall in love with him. And if you just give him a solid home stretch, you can have every single casual rooting for Gavin by the time the finale rolls around. And I, trust me, Dom, you know, I'm always polling the casuals, finding out what they thought. And you are right that many of them expressed some disappointment in Rick particularly not winning, but I believe across the board they all said they wanted Chris to win once Final Tribal Council rolled around.
Right, and for as much as we both love talking about the editing and season-long narratives and so on, maybe this is the loudest possible statement that none of that matters. If you can create a winner that the audience at large is happy with in the space of one episode with this self-contained story arc, then why does anything else even matter? Why are we making these assumptions about what they can or should be doing or what their mindset actually is, when clearly our perspective that we're bringing to that is so completely different from what the target audience's is?
Well, essentially, my entire case against the overt winner edit is just how unnecessary it is and how easy it is to get the casuals on board with whoever the eventual winner is, even just over the course of a finale. And in giving, for instance, the Michelle Fitzgerald treatment at that point in time, you are essentially only serving to tip off the people who are savvy to that kind of thing. And the casuals are never going to remember these throwaway Michelle confessionals that you are weaving into every single episode all over the place. And they will just get on board come finale time, and that will be totally fine.
Yeah, so you're coming at it from, I guess, the other direction, where not having to operate under those constraints, it sounds pretty liberating, actually, if you're one of these editors.
It'd be amazing.
Yeah. You can just do whatever you want. You show you don't have to carefully construct this story arc with lots of throwbacks and continuous self-reference or whatever. You can just put in the fun moments that you enjoy, or some of the greatest hits from the season every episode. It doesn't need to connect together. It can just be a fun 42 minutes of television, and then you come back next week and it's the same again and again and again. And at the end, if someone who was barely featured in that goes on to win, well, that's okay, because everyone still had a good time watching the season, so who cares?
Right. Yeah, I think it would be tremendously liberating in terms of storytelling to be a bit more week to week with the characters, and not necessarily need to show someone being more or less glowing all season long and others being more or less negative all season long. I think the world is your oyster if you abandon this, what I would consider deeply flawed idea that the winner needs to get some kind of special treatment. Anyway, I'm sure plenty more on Chris and how all of this came about along the way, but I wanted to get, we're making bad time here, Dom. We're 20 minutes into this podcast and we've made it through one note. Let's start with something I noticed in the previously on, or once again, just kind of lack of previously on. I'm not going to call that a main story entering season 39, but I'm going to be really curious to see what becomes of the previously on entering season 39. And every single finale, I'm pretty sure in history, starts with like at least 5 minute long previously on recapping the bulk of the season and setting up all of the people who are still alive entering the finale and giving a quick little synopsis of their story to that point. This season's previously on for the finale was not even 30 seconds, and it just ran. Jeff just gave the first names of the people who were still alive in the game, and of course, in retrospect, it's so obvious that must be because the re-enterer goes on to win, and nothing that happened to this point even mattered.
So a minute into the finale, when they go into the main title sequence, should that have been the sign? Should you have logged it in right there that not only was like Lauren or whoever not going to steal a win, but it had to be specifically the person who came back second from Edge of Extinction?
I think that might be a little too much of a leap, especially when the previously on had been getting cut down, if not entirely cut out, all season long. I guess credit to them for a well-balanced range there. But yeah, in like I said, in retrospect, it really stands out of like, oh, of course they would just kill that whole segment when nothing that really matters there, or nothing that really happens there matters. And I also thought, I think over the course of the episodes, maybe it got brought up once or something, but we really should have had a few more questions about Rick, just on the grounds that we never, virtually ever, as far as I can remember, heard him talk about his kids. We got to see his wife for a little bit, but every winner who has a wife and kids gets to talk about them relentlessly. And that, I remember during Ghost Island, was my determining factor entering the finale. I said, it's pretty much a toss up for me between Wendell and Dom, but I'm leaning Wendell just because of how little we're hearing about Dom and his wife and kids. And it's, you know, that's something they would hammer home if he were to go on to win. And in retrospect, Devin's may be the cementing example in, if you are someone who's playing Survivor and has a family and we're not hearing about it, you are not the winner.
Yeah, that might be the most reliable hack at this point for figuring out the edit. And if I'm sitting at home and I'm a finalist in what I think is going to be a close vote and I don't know how it's actually going to play out, if I have kids and I don't see them mentioned, I'm going to start to be seriously concerned going into the finale here.
So, trivia question, Dom. His kids are named Jack and Juliet, which is a reference to what?
Well, Rick is a literary man, I'm sure. I imagine it's some very obscure thing that I can't be expected to know off the top of my head.
A very obscure, not quite literary, but televised event. Not many people watched it. It was called Lost. It aired on some channel one has.
Well, I'm told that ended badly, too, so I guess it's a nice throwback there.
As I said on Sunday night, the people who wrote the final season of Lost must be popping the champagne this week, now that they're finally off the hook, now that Game of Thrones has let people down.
Yeah, the Dexter and How I Met Your Mother writing teams are, yes, are really having a ball with this one.
Yeah, so I also just wanted to say the other reason that these things may not have stood out to me in terms of why Rick might not be the winner is, at this point on finale day, I'll be honest, I was really struggling all week long in trying to figure out what I was rooting for on finale night, just because a Rick win seemed like such a foregone conclusion. And when the day of the finale rolled around, I was in just full-blown Stockholm syndrome mode, where I wanted Rick to win in like the most annoying way possible that would make production as happy as they could possibly be, because I wanted to, and we'll get, I have more to say about this later, but I felt like almost liberating myself from caring about Survivor to the extent that I previously did could be a very good thing, and Devin's winning in some like egregious fashion could free up a lot of my more stressed out hours.
Yeah, and maybe if they get everything they could possibly want from the winner of the season, they'll take their foot off the pedal a bit for future seasons, and they've had their fun, so they don't need to tamper with the game as much as they have been in recent seasons, and we can have our fun again, maybe. So,
well,
yeah, yeah, go ahead.
Well, just to jump in, for me, it was not like the direct opposite of that, but for me, Devin's winning in some like overtly producer manipulated way would like free me from ever really caring about an outcome on Survivor again. The comparison I had been making, and I've said this on previous podcasts before, about just how differently I've watched the show The Challenge on MTV. I care about it so much less and can just enjoy it so much more because I'm there to watch it. And it's just whatever happens is fun and I don't really care. There's no real concept of game integrity. And I'm just at the point now with Survivor where I'm ready to be in that state of mind. And I think this finale did a lot of good for me in that department.
Yeah, so for me, I had this internal debate over whether I want Rick to win in a semi-normal fashion. So disregarding everything completely abnormal that's happened up to this point, if Rick just wins the last few challenges, makes it to the end, and wins via a traditional-ish route, like the Mike Holloway kind of journey to the end, maybe that's okay. Maybe I can talk myself into that only having one or two asterisks by it when we do the eventual power rankings. Or do I want it to be so weighed down with asterisks that it just drops off the board entirely and I don't have to talk myself into being okay with the outcome or into having any expectations for what to I should be hoping for in future seasons, kind of what you were alluding to.
Right, but I wanted the asterisk to define the season.
Yeah, but that entire debate is with the implicit assumption that, of course, Rick is going to win, right? I mean, what else could we even be in store for? And I know some people had floated the idea of, what if this has to be the biggest decoy edit of all time? Because knowing that the second returnee is going to go back to win, you need something to occupy our minds for the main game. Why not have this guy who has this underdog story, who is great in front of the camera, who is always like pulling pranks and hustling and trying to make things happen and getting into controversy and so on. Why not just focus on him at the expense of everything else, knowing that none of that, nothing else, or him is going to matter ultimately in the end?
Yeah, well, to cut to the chase, one thing that I think is kind of going overlooked here because Rick didn't end up winning is, as far as I can tell, the producers did everything they possibly could to get Rick the win. It just didn't work out where he wasn't able to get the necklace or win the fire challenge at Final Four. But still, he found three idols. And by the way, a fun fact that I stumbled on earlier today that has really set my mind at ease to an even greater degree in terms of ever caring about the outcome on this show again is... I was listening. We're recording this so late that the Rick Devens retrospective on RHAP is already out. And he didn't frame it in these terms, but he did note in his interview with Rob that he was out there looking for idols during the early days. He just couldn't find any. And I then did the math and I looked up when it was he started finding idols. He found his first idol in episode 11 and then found two more to have a completely clean path to a Final Four immunity and fire challenge for his ticket into the finals. Coincidentally, Dom, Ben Dreeberg in Survivor Heroes Healers Hustlers had no idols in his possession for like the first 25, 27 days of the game or so, finds his first idol at Final Eight and finds enough to get it through to Final Four untouched again. And to me, that is just too much. Like, there's no way I will accept that as a fan of the show. And I don't even know if necessarily the issue is there are too many idols on Survivor. The issue is the idols are constantly going to the people who are going to use the idols to make better TV. And furthermore, they are constantly going to the people that production wants to see win the game. And it's far beyond the point that this could even conceivably be a coincidence for me. It's completely off the table that this is anything short of heavy-handed production interference in both of these cases. And while on one hand that is quite liberating, it's not the greatest feeling in the world to see that defined season after season, especially when it seems like the producers continue to view this as the best case scenario. Like, I think in their perfect world, Rick would have won that fire challenge and he would be the one who completed this miraculous hero journey.
And I do worry now that with all of this hype building around season 40 in what should be this ultimate throwdown, this great game of Survivor with some of the best players the game has ever seen, if those criteria that have made them some of the best of the best are not going to factor into the game all that much compared to this deluge of idols and advantages and other stuff, which is sure to be there in the end game on that season too. Like, I would be highly concerned that we're going to get to, let's say, Final 7 or Final 6 there, having seen a great season up until that point, and then the rest is going to feel like a game unto itself, where it's just who is in the best spot to be favored in terms of having these idols and stuff just shower down upon them.
Maybe the best case scenario is season 39, the fire challenge also results in the result that they don't want. And then they can sell it as, hey, season 40 All-Stars, we're going back to the old school way of doing it and just never go back to the fire challenge again.
It really seemed like Jeff was not happy with the outcome here, right? Like, you got that vibe as well?
I don't know. I think Chris would be their second choice out of the people who were alive at Final Six. But yeah, no, I think there's no question they wanted Devins to complete the journey, and that's why they handed him idols until Final Four. And it wasn't their fault that he couldn't win the challenge or do the fire.
Or that he gave his half of the idol back to Chris to save him, and then to set up Chris being there at Final Four to beat him in the first place.
I think they were probably on board with that.
You think so?
I would imagine so. I think they viewed Chris at that point already as the second best person to see win. I think this was...
Well, yeah, if they could have their druthers, they would want Rick to beat Chris in that Final Four challenge, right? And then that's the thing which officially inaugurates Rick as the winner here.
Right, and then they can also hang that hypothetical over Chris's head forever of the guy who gave up immunity at Final Four.
Yeah, and that maybe is an even better like storybook ending to the season, right? And instead we get this this firestorm over the ending instead, which was quickly brushed under the rug by bigger news in the Survivor fandom. But I wonder what the official verdict on the season is going to be, because we know that the way that production, including Jeff, but I wonder if it's even correct to use him as a representative mouthpiece for the larger show at this point, because if, for as much as he is the voice that we get to hear and see, I don't know if he speaks for the entire group. I know there have been times in the past where Jeff has had just opinions about, let's say, a premise for a season, including season 40, actually. He was vocal about thinking this wasn't the right time for all winners, and now we're seeing all winners. So it's unclear what degree of influence he actually has over all of these proceedings here. But you get the sense that he was not overly happy with this outcome. And I don't know if you ask him again in 3 or 4 years, what lessons will have been learned from that, if any.
I think this season will obviously not be forgotten anytime soon. But I think it will be more fun to think back on 3 or 4 years from now when we are not on the heels of just having dedicated so much time and interest in 3 months of stuff that didn't end up mattering. I think, you know, if you get back to us in 2024, we may even look fondly back upon, remember that time that some dude showed up in the finale and just sniped the season from everyone else?
Yeah, so the hardcore Survivor purists bring this up all the time in the context of idols, right? So they think back to simpler days when being voted out of the show or receiving a majority of the votes meant that you were done, with the exception of what they would, by broad consensus, agree is the best season of all time. So that's one wrinkle in the equation there. But by and large, if you were voted out, you were voted out. And that was the end of your Survivor journey, and that was it. And that was seen as proof that if you had been voted out, you had committed some cardinal sin in the game, right? You could have played better. You could have... there was the fundamental social aspect of Survivor. The other people had done that better than you in order to stick around for longer than you have. And we've always questioned that logic, and that debate has always been there. But that was at least an understandable perspective to approach a show from. And then as idols became a bigger and bigger part of the show, finding idols and using them to save yourself became something that you could hang your hat on rather than something which you would have to like put your tail between your legs and shuffle home with. So if you were on the docket to get voted out and you sprung an idol and you saved yourself and you blindsided someone, that was seen as an achievement more so than anything else. And now it feels like it's inescapable. The stats on how many winners recently have not had an idol or used one or had one used on them at some point, it is basically a requirement to win the show now. And I don't know if it's just a function of their approach to having this many idols in the game, where if you're lasting that long and you're in a power position, then you're probably going to find one, or if that's just something that you need now to have your game be respected. But either way, it's very difficult to get the $1 million and get the title now without idols factoring into the equation in some way. And so if you extrapolate from that, I don't know if this is categorically different, but I do worry now that if we get to, you know, season 50, season 60, if even this will look quaint by comparison to some of what's going on in there.
I certainly think that is possible, but you are right that it is often the idols that come across as the things people are getting a ton of credit for. My resounding takeaway from these last several seasons is not just you have to have idols or a bunch of immunities in order to win. It is the producers need to be okay with you winning for you to win, or you have no chance.
Yeah, and someone unearthed this money quote from Matt Van Wagenen from this interview he did with Dalton Ross back in 2017. So I'll read that quickly. I feel like there are a couple of seasons where we felt one way and it's kind of been the opposite. If I'm going to be totally candid, I think season 30, we were kind of jazzed about season 30 and we went out there and we watched Mike Holloway kind of run through the competition and we thought it was a real fun story to watch. And he was fighting against some people who a lot of fans didn't love. And I think that we realized in that case, maybe not, that's not what they're looking for. I think one of the things we learned from there is that you want to have a lot of people to root for. And that's where I look at a season where we can say, and we've seen it in recent seasons since then, where you look at the people heading into the finale and you go, gosh, I could see myself rooting for all of them. If we sit there the first day of the finale and I can say, I root for all of these people to win, then I know we've got a good season on our hands. And that's recent, right? That's 2017. It's not that long in the show's overall life cycle. And it feels like we have moved completely away from that at this point. And I don't know if we're ever returning there.
So it brings me to a question that I've been thinking a lot about, because I think they nailed that dynamic on David versus Goliath for a long time. And that was, you know, last season, I think, was by pretty much all accounts a home run in a multitude of ways. But I am increasingly concerned, Dom, and I think season 40 is going to be the real litmus test here, that David versus Goliath was a fluke. I don't know how else I can look at the last several seasons, 34 through 38, with one exception, seemed to me to be a completely misguided attempt at making a captivating season of Survivor.
And it's all the more frustrating then, right? Because you have this example of what Survivor could and should look like. They're in front of them, and it's clear that they can do that. It's one of the more recent seasons of the show, and yet none of the lessons there have been learned. And I wonder if you can look at that Matt Van Wagenen quote in a different light, where you think that in Worlds Apart, that is maybe different from the Ben storyline or the Rick storyline, insofar as the people he was going against there were actively unlikable. They were people who you were rooting against more so than just not having any opinion on. And so if you go into the finale and it's people like Gavin, who, for as much as, you know, there's been a lot of debate around Gavin is a very just nondescript figure, right? It's hard to imagine anyone really hating Gavin. They might have some contempt for the way he played the game, but no one's going to quit watching the show because their delicate moral sensibilities have been offended by Gavin taking home the title. Maybe that's the way for them to square that circle, where if they just don't give anyone much substance whatsoever, no one's going to be upset if any of them go on to win, and no one's going to be rooting that hard for them to win either. So if one of them steals it, then okay, whatever, we move on. But then the one or two people that we do decide to build up and they're going to drag all the attention to them, one of them is going to win and that's going to be fine. And so everyone's going to be happy with any outcome here.
Yeah, I'm increasingly nervous for about 18 months from now or so, when we see season 41 play, when we've seen all of that play out, you know, fingers crossed that it's still going on in season 41, because I'm counting on the all winners season being good pretty much regardless of what the producers do. I think that cast is just bulletproof. But if we have 38, you know, not blow us away, to say the least, 39 is potentially another relatively weak effort, and then 41 is also, I don't want to say phoned in, but just not capturing the magic the same way pretty much any season other than David versus Goliath has for years at that point, I am going to be really nervous about the future of Survivor.
And especially if season 40 is underwhelming compared to the very high standards that we all will surely have for it, then that's going to be the death knell of the show for a lot of fans, where it's like, with the best possible cast we could hope to assemble, we still had a season that maybe was underwhelming compared to what we had in mind for it. why even bother engaging with the show when we're never going to have that greater cast again, and we're going to go back to the levels of Edge of Extinction or 39 if that's underwhelming too. And yeah, if 41 is a dud, then I think a lot of people are just going to stop watching or disengage heavily from the fan base at that point.
Right, and just to clarify, certainly hoping for the best for both 39 and 41. I would love
it. Yeah, just to clarify, I don't want my favorite show to suck in case there was any misapprehension about that, you know?
I'm not rooting against Survivor. I'm just saying if both 39 and 41 are underwhelming, that's going to be an enormous concern for me.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. All right, so let's get back into this finale. Chris is going to win the re-entry challenge, and Joe comes extremely close. And when this news broke about the Edge of Extinction existing in the first place and that Joe was going to be back on the show, I believe the news broke like before the season had even finished filming. The overwhelming reaction was, oh, this is obviously so rigged to help Joe. And we saw just how close that actually ended up coming in, where he is a few inches off from getting that second ball in. And while it's not Joe himself that we see go on to take the Joe path to victory here, it is certainly the Joe type that goes on to benefit from this twist for sure.
Yeah, Joe, as he said to Jeff, he doesn't know if someone like him can win the game, despite the fact that the winners of his seasons are Mike, Jeremy, and Chris, who all to various degrees fit in the same mold as he does. But as we check in with this reunion quickly, I'm very sad that we've lost one of the, by now, time-honored traditions of the reunion show, and that's having a small child in the audience predict the winner. And knowing what was about to happen here, if I was in production, I would have tipped off some small child before the Edge of Extinction challenge had even happened to write Chris's name down on that piece of paper just to see if people would go along with it or say anything at the end.
Yeah, I noticed that as well, the lack of little kid vote, and I think it confirms our theory that we've floated since the very first time that happened, which is they'll never, ever let the little kid be wrong, and the little kid can never be wrong because it's a plant every time. They pull a bunch of little kids and find one who is unambiguously rooting for the eventual winner.
Yeah, and I guess the audience at large, however credulous they may be, would not be able to suspend their disbelief even for this one. But yeah, Joe is voted out and gets his own standing ovation from the audience and his own segment with Jeff, despite the fact that other people in this finale, like Victoria and Lauren, will definitely not get that same treatment, predictably. But yeah, we were concerned at the start, as everyone else was, that this was going to be just automatic for Joe coming back in. And I guess when you have this many Joe-esque people on the season, even if it's not Joe himself, it's going to be one of them as a stand-in, right? So how different is Chris from Joe, from Eric, from and so on and so forth, right? And I think the answer actually is pretty different in this case. I don't know if Joe would be able to pull off what Chris did in these last few days. I don't know if he necessarily would have had the balls to give out the necklace of Final Four and go against Chris, in part because I don't think he would have needed to. I think Joe would have won just on his own. I don't want to say on his own merits, but just by virtue of being Joe, if he'd made it to the end. And I think he would have had a much bigger target on him. I don't think Lauren could be convinced to play the idol on him, so Joe would have to win there. I don't know if Rick would give him the half of the idol or whatever. So I think, bearing that in mind, when we start by looking at Joe and then compare it to Chris, maybe Chris's path does look even more different, Colin, compared to how it could have done. But yeah, Joe just, his whole presence on the season was so enigmatic. Like, it was so small compared to what it could have been, and in a way I wish it had been larger. Does that make sense? Do you see where I'm coming from here? Like,
not really.
Okay, well, I'll try to think of a way to set this up, because not being a Joe fan, the fact that even Joe was sidelined to the point of irrelevance is the perfect proof of how absurd the constraints Edge of Extinction places on everything else that you have to work into your show. So I'm sure they could have done just a weekly check-in with Joe over on Edge of Extinction and marginalized everybody else even further. But he just got lumped in with everybody else out there with the Rons and the Erics and the Julias, which might be an even worse fate for him and for his fans out there.
Confirmed Joe superfan. Dumb. It's a thrilling evolution.
It's just the eyes and the hair. I'm just overwhelmed, Colin.
Well, bad news. The hair is gone now. Sia paid him $15,000 to cut his hair off. Which, incidentally, I was talking to someone about that. And they said it seems like a dystopian future, right? Like rich people just paying poor people to be there, not necessarily poor people, but paying people to like be their puppets. It really does seem like a Black Mirror episode that is waiting to be written and poorly executed.
Mm-hmm. And yeah, if I was Sia, there would be many, many things to give tens of thousands of dollars to before Joe or really anyone who goes on reality TV.
Yeah. So actually, incidentally, Jeff seemed really interested in the prospect of having Joe back again, like begging him to come back on soon. Are we going to see Joe back on Survivor a fourth time?
It feels like a lock at this point, right?
I'm not going to call it a lock, but I would say, you know, given even money on either side, I would be betting yes.
I wonder if there's room for, and I don't know if I would even hate this necessarily, but if there's room for people like Joe to come back just for the challenge portion in some capacity, whether it's as a coach or as they get to compete and then there's some like side part going on, or I don't know what would happen here, but like I would not be too offended if the Joes and Aussies of the world turn up just for the challenges. They wouldn't have to play the social part of the game, which they struggle with more and don't seem to even enjoy that much themselves. We don't have to watch them play that part, so we get to watch the main game of Survivor unaffected by that. And so it's almost like the best of both worlds, where the Joe and Aussie fans get what they want, the people who are just looking at the social and strategic side of the show get what they want, and everyone leaves happy, maybe.
I think the functionality there is going to need some fine-tuning in terms of how that would hypothetically work. But yeah, I remember years ago, the topic came up somehow of like a one-off special or something they could do where they have some of like the all-time great challenge competitors compete in like a series of challenges for some sort of prize money. I think that would be cool to bring in Ozzy and Joe and Tyson or whoever you want and have them do like a best of five or whatever. I think would be, even as someone who doesn't care that much about the challenges normally, I would be interested in seeing that.
Yeah, I would love to watch that, honestly.
The problem is they'd have to come up with five different looking challenges, and they all look the same now.
Yeah, you stand on this platform, and then you go and stand on this platform, and then maybe we can work a table maze in there towards the end or something. But yeah, but this Edge of Extinction challenge actually highlights the lack of creativity that we saw across the challenges this season, where going into it, you would think, this is meant to push you to your limits, to test your endurance, test how much you really want this. And so I was expecting this clash of the titans between all these different people. I didn't know what that would look like necessarily, but I assumed the challenge would be something where everybody can put in their maximum effort and see that get rewarded. And instead, it was just it's almost like the first challenge after the merge, where you have 12 different people there, and there's some convoluted course where they all have to go through all of these different stages, and then there's a puzzle at the end and so on. And it's so easy to just lose track of people. So if you've been waiting the entire season to see what let's say Aubrey or Chris or whoever else is gonna do in that challenge, there's a good chance you don't even get to see them participate, basically, because the focus has to be on everybody else, and you're not going to pay any attention to someone who is lagging behind the rest of the pack and who finishes in a solid seventh place in that challenge, right? Whereas if it was, like, I was expecting some kind of all-day, all-night endurance challenge. So thinking back to UK Survivor, actually, where they had one of the late challenges was just standing on a log. And that lasted for over 24 hours, I believe, because everyone just stayed up there. They knew what the stakes were. They knew how important it was. And even though this was early 2000s, grainy, relatively amateurish TV at that point, you still had this amazing time-lapse sequence, as I recall, of just the day turning to night with all of them still standing up there motionless, waiting for the other to give in. And I was expecting some true test of grit and endurance like that. And instead, it was just yet another formulaic Survivor challenge where there's just nothing to follow and nothing to write home about.
I think the days of Survivor challenges going longer than a couple of hours are almost off the table. I think Christian hanging up there, however long he did, next to, I think it was Alec, in David versus Goliath, was way longer than pretty much any challenge we've seen in years. And I don't think that even hit 6 hours. But yeah, I mean, you think back to Tom and Ian hanging on the buoys in Palau. You think back to Tina Wesson standing on the perch in Australia for like 12 hours or whatever. These, you know, Hands on the Idol was the signature final immunity challenge for so long. And it just seems completely off the table at this point. And I'm sure there are plenty of reasons for that, not the least of which is they have better, you know, Jeff Probst doesn't want to stand out there for 24 hours. Forget it.
Well, he's being paid millions of dollars an episode. He can get over it, frankly. He can buck up. But this is, to me, it felt like a lost opportunity or a missed opportunity, whatever it is, because this could have been one of the high points of the season. Even if you disagree ideologically with all of the changes being made to the game and with this twist even existing in the first place, this could have been one of the iconic, memorable Survivor challenges, right? You have these people who, in some cases, are on their second or third time playing, all of them hungry for the win. They spend 2 or 3 weeks out there just waiting, biding their time, building towards this moment. And you could have 10 of them in this all-day, all-night slugfest to see who gets to return, and it just fell through the cracks. There's nothing there.
I agree that it would have been extremely interesting. The issue, I'm sure, in this case, is not only do we not want to be out here for 20 consecutive hours, but we, with six people left, have zero wiggle room, ding the bell, in terms of the schedule. We can't afford to potentially lose a night and then not be able to run the immunity challenge tomorrow afternoon and vote someone else out tomorrow night. Like, we don't have an extra day to make this up later if this runs long.
You can find the day.
There are 39 days on the season.
No, I'm saying you can mess with the schedule within those 39 days to make room for this. If you're already bending the boundaries of the season to such a great degree, you can find an extra few hours in an afternoon somewhere.
It would require doing a daytime tribal council.
Fine, do it.
I don't think they would ever say an endurance challenge is worth doing the first daytime challenge or tribal council.
I would disagree. But look, either way, I think they could have done so much more with this, and they didn't. And I don't want to say that I hope we see Edge of Extinction again so we can see this done right. But if we have to see it through Edge of Extinction again, then I hope they at least put some more thought into that aspect of it.
Okay, I agree with you that that would be cool. I will find zero fault with them for not doing that. I think this is the last time they would ever consider doing that kind of challenge.
Okay, you will find fault with them for basically everything else about
sure,
this finale,
but
though.
But
so
that is a completely
be,
unfair gripe.
Yeah, we got to be, giving it where it's due.
You need to call good things good and bad things bad.
I can't just call everything bad.
Calling everything good or everything bad is equally nothing. Like the only people you should trust are people who are willing to call good things good and bad things bad.
I feel like there's a false equivalence there. I don't think calling everything good is the same as calling everything bad.
In terms of your credibility, it doesn't matter. To me, there is no difference to pick a name at random between you calling everything bad and Haley Strong calling everything good. Neither of you is ever credible because you would say that either way.
Well, look, my credibility is unimpeachable. I'm not going to accept any attacks on that.
Oh, Dom. So, yeah, I guess no more on Joe or the reentry challenge from me. Do you have anything else on that?
No, other than to just tart disappointedly.
Okay, so we get Chris back in the game. Chris is gifted an idol, or half an idol, if you want to get technical about it, where he gives the other half to someone else, and he can't use it at this next vote, but it is good at exactly final five. And at this point, when I saw Rick ask what was in his bag and Chris grins, I was fully expecting there to be nothing in Chris's bag because we're down to six people now. It would be insane to give him anything too meaningful within the game. But when he pulls out another hidden immunity idol being gifted to the re-enterer, I literally started clapping at my TV because this is exactly what I wanted at this point, is Chris gets gifted an idol, and please believe when Devins finds that idol later, I was loving life.
I was fully expecting him to get given something, and I was almost surprised it wasn't a full idol from the outset. I guess you can't guarantee that he's going to make it through the round. There has to be some work that he has to do for it, but I would have been stunned with anything less, frankly.
Yeah, I guess I was open to the possibility of there being some kind of minor thing in his bag, but any sort of immunity for this vote or any future vote to me is way overpowered and far beyond the point of ridiculousness. But either way, Julie is going to win this immunity challenge with a bit of help from Chris there, which Devins wasn't too thrilled about. But Devins still has his own idol. And that one is going to be good here, and he's good through Final Five and can continue his effortless march to victory. And now it is just a matter of who is actually going to leave. And we see Chris confront Lauren about this idol that he knows she has, because Wentworth spilled the beans off on the edge of extinction, and Chris is able to sell her on the idea that the jury's been just waiting, Lauren, for you to make a big move with your idol. And Dom, this is something we flagged up about the idea of the second re-enterer just having carte blanche to say, what is that the right use of carte blanche to say anything they
sure,
want to convince the players in the game that the jury wants whatever.
Yeah, and they can invent whatever they please because it has that air of credibility coming from someone who you know has spent that much time with them and who probably does have an incentive to make things up, to sell you on adding in a certain way, but they do have this privileged access to information that other people simply don't. And so, for example, when Chris was trying to sell Lauren on going after Victoria, I wasn't sure if Victoria was actually the jury threat that Chris was making her out to be, because she very plausibly could have been based on his conversations with the entire jury now over the course of like 20 days, or if that was just the line which he thought it made the most sense to try and spin based on, again, those same conversations that he had with all the jury members whose opinions he now knows better than anybody.
Yeah, and how do you argue against that? If Lauren's saying, hey, Chris is saying you're the biggest jury threat, what do you, no, I'm not. And it's like, well, this guy's been sitting right, with the jury.
Like, on the one hand, I've been there living with the jurors for 3 weeks now, and I can testify that they all like Victoria. On the other hand, no, they don't. There's really no balance of evidence there.
Yeah. So Lauren ends up playing her idol that she sat on for all of these incredibly intense tribals council, has been just pocketing for a rainy day so she can use it to keep herself safe in some critical vote. She ends up using it on Chris here. Obviously, in retrospect, I'm sure a move she would like back. But what did you make of this, Dom? Because this blew me away in the moment.
I was stunned. I thought this was the scrambling of a desperate man, and fair play to him for trying to come up with some idea to get him through that round. But surely there's no way this makes sense for anybody, right? And then when she got up and played the idol for Chris, very nonchalantly, as if this was the most obvious thing in the world, I was floored. Listening to her arguments for it after the game, it does make some amount of sense. But the big overriding issue for me, which no matter how logical it might seem, I think this has to be the thing at the front of your mind, is that if you get, you know that Rick is safe, or you have to very strongly suspect Rick is safe. If Rick and Chris both make it to Final Five, at least one of them is guaranteed to make it to Final Four, at which point they have two shots at the Final Three, and it's very likely, given that Rick has won several challenges by himself, Chris has won the re-entry challenge and seems like a big challenge threat, and both of them seem competent at fire, based on what you know, one of them is going to end up in the Final Three, basically, and that person is going to be nigh on impossible to beat. So you can argue that, okay, how likely in a post-Ben world is it that Rick is just going to be... you're going to have a clear shot at Rick at Final Five? Probably not that likely, ultimately, or Chris, depending on which one of them is still there. But just guaranteeing that at least one of them makes it to the end just seems so unnecessarily risky to me. Yeah. That even if there's a good argument for this in the abstract, you just have to basically vote out the returning players again, right? At one point, this was Kelly and David and Aubrey and Joe, and now it's Rick and Chris. It's these people who come into the game with a completely different status, and if you don't acknowledge that, then there's no way you can beat it.
Yeah, it I thought when she stood up, she was, of course, going to play it on herself at long last. She's going to finally reveal or I guess the jury knew about it, but to everyone but Chris left in the game, Lauren is going to, or not even at this round, but be able to use it at Final Five and like just sit on it here and then be able to say at Final Tribal Council, I got to, you know, I essentially played my idol because there was no time left for it to be valid. And I think that's a very compelling argument, is someone being able to sit on an idol correctly for a long time is potentially, honestly, even more impressive than someone playing a bunch of idols on themselves correctly.
I would agree, but I don't know if the average Survivor jury nowadays is going to share that perspective.
But I think you kind of need them to have that perspective if you have any chance at all against Rick or Chris.
Maybe you just write off the possibility of having a chance against Rick or Chris, and you maximize the odds of making sure that neither one of them makes it there.
Yeah, I'm guessing Lauren and Gavin and Victoria and Julie were not too interested in the idea of Chris or Rick making it there.
Yeah, you see the jury are just like hooting and applauding every time Rick puts on one of his cabaret shows at Tribal Council. And so you can tell they have they like the theatrics, right? They like the big moves, and you're not going to be able to sell them that, well, actually, inaction is a bigger move than action. I don't think that line is going to work with this group.
Right. And I do think, by the way, that they can feel pretty comfortable about Rick having an idol, because as regular listeners will remember, a few weeks ago when he played his first idol, I said, take careful note of Rick's behavior during this tribal council when he knew he had a secret idol he was going to play. And this time around, Dom, again, here at Final Six, exact same situation where not a word from Rick Devons about his hidden immunity idol. Compare that to when he's pretending he's going to play it on Julie. All he can do is tell you that you're over and over what a huge mistake you're making, thinking that he's not going to play it tonight. So I think I was happy to see that one come in even better than I could have drawn it up. It was so right. Obvious that, you know, and this is not just Rick. This is something I genuinely believe should be a regular thing people look for going forward on Survivor seasons, are people's tells with idols, because they are so overt.
Yeah, it's also a little grim irony too that after Angelina last season, we started the season with Lauren and Kelly and Aubrey all finding idols, and then Kelly and Aubrey get voted out with idols in their pocket, and Lauren essentially hands the game to Chris by playing hers on him at the same time as Rick is finding idols left and right and being handed idols and making fake idols, making two in the same round. And it's just any hope of more equity on that front seems to be completely down the shitter at this point. But I did think going into Rick's attempt to kind of throw them off the scent by making these fake idols, was it Julie who said something like, I expect there to be maybe one or two idols left in the game? And I thought, if anything, she might be underselling it, right? Like, it's a sad reflection on the state of affairs that is a realistic thing to think and to expect. And if anything, it would not shock me if there were two idols just thrown back into the game against their stated principles.
Maybe this is naive of me, but it would shock me if they put two idols back. I understand why Julie would try to talk herself into that in the moment. There's no real downside. You can always hope that that's what they're doing. But I would have been floored, and will in any future season be floored, if two idols are re-entered in the same round. Have we ever seen that two idols get re-entered?
Again, when we are commiserating over the results of season 52, I'll be sure to quote
right.
you on that.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, I understood where Julie was coming from. I see how she could talk herself into that line of thinking. And again, I don't blame her for going out just in case there is an extra idol out there. But I was certainly not feeling like that was something that at this point in time would be realistic. But again, ask me again in 6 years.
Right.
Yeah. So I guess let's quickly get into parting thoughts on Victoria here at Final Six. And I guess even before, thoughts on her specifically, how did she end up being the one who got voted out here, as far as we know, based on exit interviews to this point? Because the show, as far as I could tell, really did nothing to explain how she ended up leaving, other than I think just implying she was viewed as the next biggest threat because of what Chris said about her being a jury threat.
And it seems like that is corroborated by what other people are saying too, so maybe there is some truth to that. But in a way, it comes down to just process of elimination, right? Like, when so many people are safe for various reasons, then someone has to be the target, and who better than Victoria?
Yeah. So what did you think of Victoria over the course of this season?
I liked her. I was worried that if she made it to the end, then her more under the radar style of play would not be recognized by, again, a jury who is all about the big public performance. And maybe that kind of saved her in a way, where if she had made it to the end and lost, it would be harder for people to defend what they're reading into her edit that wasn't shown, if that makes sense. Where if she is conclusively rejected by the jury, I mean, you can give the argument that people have given for every losing finalist that they're a fan of, that, oh, well, if they only knew what they were missing, then maybe they would see things differently. But I don't know. I think there was a lot of substance to her game. It's hard to tell exactly how much because of the nature of what her game is. But I liked her. I don't think she's going to be in contention to return. I don't think she has this big following outside of the online fan base. But I liked her for what she brought to the season, for sure.
Yeah, I was way too low on Victoria for too long. Victoria is, without a doubt, a baller out there playing Survivor. And it was a lot of fun watching Victoria. And I was pretty upset that she didn't end up making it even further, because I thought she did add a really fun element to the show when we actually got to hear from her. And according to pretty much all of the exit press that I've seen and heard, it seemed like Victoria was someone that was getting at least a decent enough amount of respect out there. And I'm probably with you that she is more unlikely than not to return. Sorry for the double negative, but I don't see that happening necessarily. Although I would be, at this point, for sure here for that. Victoria seemed to me like the exact kind of person I want to see cast on the show. Someone who really knows what they're doing and is out there to play hard.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So there goes Victoria. We are down to five. And just to be on the safe side, Dom, we don't know if Devins is going to win the immunity yet, so we got to get him another idol. He ends up picking that one up, and this is his third idol of the season. We've already talked a little about just the two decoys he planted, but what did you think about Rick and his new idol and those decoys, if you have any other thoughts on that, other than just feeling bad for Lauren and Julie continuing the line, as you ran down earlier, of Angelina, Aubrey, Wentworth, Lauren misusing her idol, and now these two again getting just duped by fake idols as Rick is made to look like a hero genius.
Yeah, so I think there is a difference between what Rick was doing here and what Angelina was trying to do, at least at first. I mean, at some point it did become Rick just toying with his food a little bit. So at one point there was a good rationale for, I want them to not know that I have one and also be consumed with looking for one themselves rather than scheming and trying to coordinate on what they're going to do. But it felt just like such a foregone conclusion that of course Rick was going to come out of this round unscathed and looking like a hero, and everyone else was going to look like idiots who couldn't come up with a way to outsmart him. And it just felt like, can we skip that part already? Do we have to go through the motions here?
Yeah, you are right. It was uncomfortable, to say the least, for me to watch all this go down. Although, again, in the moment, I thought this was just the latest chapter, the almost like penultimate chapter in the story of Rick Devins and how he outworked and out hustled and outplayed everyone all season long. And as a person rooting to watch the world burn in this context, it was icing on the cake in terms of the treatment he got, as far as pulling off this ruse.
Yeah.
Yeah. So there goes Lauren, who I am imagining would have loved to have an idol that was real at that tribal council, but what are you going to do? What are your final thoughts on Lauren this season?
I was not as big a fan as seemingly everybody else was, but because we were saying week by week, it is ballsy how she's always holding onto that idol, despite it's got to be so tempting when the game is so chaotic to at least play it just to buy yourself a few more days, to have that insurance with you. And she kept holding it, and I could never tell quite if it was because she was never a target because no one was spared at her, and so of course she was going to be safe, or she was so completely dialed into everything that was happening that she should have been a target probably at some point, but she knew that she wasn't going to be. And it felt like we were all agreeing on that second interpretation. And then in the finale, when it seemed like she was in a pretty decent spot, she just threw it all away with a move that I think her logic does make some amount of sense. I can see why she could talk herself into doing that, but compared to the type of praise that we were all giving her before, it is a pretty stark contrast.
So I was someone who enjoyed Lauren to the same extent that it seems like everyone else did. I thought she was awesome, and I really wish we could have seen more of her along the way, because as far as I can tell, up until near the end, it really seemed like Lauren was playing a super strong game. And as things pertain to that idol being played on Chris, assuming we get a Lauren deep dive with Rob, I am going to be really curious to hear how she phrases that decision. If it is a lot of credit to Chris and here's exactly how he played me and I fell for it hook, line, and sinker the way the editors seem to have her reiterate over and over, that is one story. I anticipate it may be something more along the lines of something was off with me that day. I didn't, I hadn't eaten in however long. Or I guess she went on a relatively recent reward. But I feel like if we hear some sort of there was a weird vibe in the air or whatever, I think I will be on the lookout for any kind of code for some kind of cover for what I believe is the real truth, which is the producers convinced her it would be a very good idea.
Yeah, I think Lauren and at least one of Lauren and Gavin, and maybe both, might be the ideal victims of Chris stealing the show in the way he did. Because if he doesn't come back in, and let's say Rick is neutralized as a threat somehow, then if we do end up with that final three, which could have saved the purity of the season, and we get some mix of Lauren, Gavin, Julie, and Victoria, there can only really be one winner there. And if it is conclusive that, let's say, Lauren loses to both Gavin and Victoria, which I don't know if that's true, but just as an example, then I don't know if there was a path for her to the end. And so for her to get bamboozled by Rick or Chris or whoever on the way out might actually be a better fate than having it laid out there that actually your game was going to inevitably end in failure. Because at least this looks like some kind of freak extinction event, right? That is just happening to the show. And if this was any other season, then your true prowess would be recognized. But I don't know. Do you have a take on that?
So to me, because my theory is the producers convinced her this would be a smart thing to do, I do not necessarily get on board with this being the best case scenario. I feel like this could be yet another season where my overwhelming takeaway is a lot like Heroes, Healers, Hustlers, where obviously I don't know any of this to be true, but it really felt like in both cases they deemed the people who were running the game to just be not nearly as interesting as the people who were on the outs, and they took the game away from the people who would have otherwise won without the producers interfering. And I feel like Lauren was a victim of that. She was deemed not a good enough story compared to Chris, and that's why she was talked into idling Chris.
How much of that is that being deemed to be true versus it just being true, right? So I don't know if Gavin is ever going to be dazzling the audience regardless of how much attention he gets. If Gavin was getting the Boston Rob Cochran coronation edit, I think people would be complaining about that, because why are we giving such a disproportionate amount of attention to someone who isn't going to engage with the audience in an interesting way?
Right, and I think they're doing the math on that in advance, and that's why they want the Ricks Devons of the world to be the ones winning.
Right, and I don't take issue with them wanting that to be the case. I take issue with them taking steps to ensure, or at least make right. It highly likely that that's the case.
Right. I can't believe this is so long ago. Here's how long ago this is, Dom. This is before the Patriots. I think this is their first Super Bowl run. When they were the like fledgling upstart scrappy underdog Patriots, and they played in the AFC Championship against the Steelers, who were like a powerhouse at that point. and everyone was rooting for New England, which LOL at that. That's how long ago it was. And I remember watching that game, and the fourth quarter, and just second half overall, were really controversial because the Steelers just kept getting flagged for everything, penalized for everything. And one of the players, it was either Cordell Stewart or if Joey Porter was on the team at that time, it might have been him, after the game, was essentially accusing the refs of, like, rigging it. And a quote that's always stuck with me is, like, it was him saying, "I understand everyone is rooting for, in this case, the Patriots to win. But if we do beat them, you can't take it away from us." And this feels like potentially another case of it being taken away from the majority alliance that was deemed too boring.
Yes.
Yeah. All right. So needless tangent aside, let's get into this Final Four challenge. Final Five, whatever challenge this is. Final Five challenge is this. I guess we skipped over it to talk to Lauren, talk about Lauren. But I did want to say about Devin's and his situation at this Final Five here. Once he wins the necklace, he has his own idol that he can use to bring anyone he wants with him along to that Final Four. And I noted the time as I was doing the rewatch, I didn't pick up on this as the finale was airing live, but unless I missed something really early into the episode, the very first time we hear one word out of Gavin's mouth in this entire finale is 1 hour and 9 minutes into it. After Rick wins the Final Five immunity challenge, Gavin congratulates him on the immunity win and now pitches this plan of, hey, if you idol me, potentially I'll take you if I win Final Four immunity.
Yeah, and it just goes to highlight how instrumental all of these people are to the Chris storyline or the Rick storyline. They are just units to be moved around on the board, and they're not players with their own agency and personalities.
They're victims.
Right? Yeah, they're going to join the line of bodies strewn across the path in the wake of Chris.
Right. And in that Devin's interview, he said at this spot, it seemed like both he and Gavin understood that Gavin was lying to him, but Rick figured, if there's any chance that this could come through, why the hell not go for it? He said, I can, you know, I have this idol I'm not using for anything else. May as well take a shot. The one idea I had that I don't think Rick had to worry much about jury votes either way in the event that he ended up making it there. But if you do have this extra idol, I thought one potentially really cool idea to kind of go in tandem with these fake idols is, if those fake idols do get played by Julie and Lauren, why not use your idol to protect one of them? It seems like in a spot where it is closer in terms of jury equity, if you can essentially like cuck Julie there and get her to play one of your fake idols and then use your own real idol to save her and lock her in a spot in the Final Four, I feel like that would have been potentially really compelling.
Yeah, it's not quite on the level of like Natalie Anderson using her idol on Baylor, right? But or on Jacqueline to get out Baylor. But there's part of the same idea behind it, where if you can just invalidate someone as a player by saving them with an idol, then there's really no argument that they can make effectively at Final Tribal against you, right?
Right.
So it's a great way to neutralize your competition potentially.
Yeah, and that's the argument we've always made against season 40 frontrunner Jeremy Collins. And I say frontrunner non-ironically. I really do think he has a very good shot out there. But the minute he idled Steven, by Steven's own admission, his response was, well, I guess I can never sit in the end with Jeremy anymore.
Right, which if you had watched Steven's season or listened to him at any point, you probably could have divined anyway, but that definitely locked it in for sure.
Yeah. The other thing that I was wondering about from this Final Five Tribal Council that I cannot make neither heads nor tails of, Dom, is when Devin's idols Gavin, Chris has yet to play his own hidden immunity idol, but before he does so, he puts on this show and acts like he's disappointed in Rick for not using his idol on him. Like, oh, come on, man, what were you doing? And then he goes, but actually, like, I have an idol of my own here. And it seemed like all you could possibly do by putting on that act is tip that you and Devons are in cahoots. Because if someone who knows they have an idol that expires this round is obviously going to play it on themselves and would not care whether Devons idols you or not. You're going to be fine either way. This has to be a ruse as far as the other players should be concerned.
A very cunning ruse, yeah. But yeah. To be fair, at that point, if you and your cahoots E, the person with whom you are in cahoots...
Co-cahooter?
Yeah, if you and your co-cahooter both have idols, then who cares, right? You have all of the variables accounted for.
Well, I think it's just like the modern tribal council dynamic is, especially with all that Devons has been doing these last few weeks, if you're not pandering, you're not trying with these jurors. You got to be like Hollywooding every single decision, or you're not. It seems like people feel like they're not going to get credit.
Yeah, it's changing the norm to the point where you now have to be this big, gregarious personality or work to put on a show to even get credit for the simplest move, which should be self-explanatory.
Proclamation, I remember Zeke being the one to put it in these terms, but I'm guessing others have felt similarly, of Tribal Council just being theater. It seems like the more that becomes conventional wisdom, the bigger people feel like they have to go over and over and over. And it's almost like the X Games always stands out to me. Do you know what the X Games are, Dom?
No idea.
The extreme sports annual competition where every single year, like in 1996, it was who can do a backflip on a bicycle. And now it's like who can do a quadruple backflip on a bicycle, because every single year they need to one up whatever happened the previous year. And that's how it feels at Tribal Council these days.
Absolutely. And I don't know if there's any way at all of resetting those stakes and just having things be normal again.
I think that's kind of not only at Tribal Council, but also the issue the producers are probably wondering about. I don't think they're going to cut down on the idols, but I think if they were even thinking about it, they may wonder to themselves, would it even be feasible to go back to a couple of idols per season? Would that not be jarring at this point?
You would have to slowly and carefully wean the audience off idols. So instead of having six a season, maybe we have four. Maybe we're not putting one back in play, re-hidden past a certain point, and then you slowly ratchet it down. But yeah, I think if you went cold turkey and the next season was just back to basics, that's the twist. The twist is that there are no twists, Colin. Then I think that really would be confusing for a lot of the audience now.
I think the modern state of Survivor is there's going to be an idol or an advantage, at least one, either introduced or played every single week. I would be very curious to see over these last few seasons the number of episodes where no idol or advantage was at least introduced or played.
Yeah, I fear that would be one of the equally kind of disappointing or surprising statistics along with all the rest of them.
Yeah, the popular graph making the rounds this week is the Game of Thrones words per minute by season, and as the words per minute goes down over time, I think, you know, a lot of people felt the season quality also went down over time, and that may be the defining reason for it. I think
George R.R. Martin definitely subscribes to the school of thought of more words the better, but I don't know how clearly that translates.
I don't know how many words per minute he's been cranking out lately, Dom.
It's a hard zero on that one, I think.
Yeah, so anyway, I think the just modern state of Survivor is crazy. Like, it's completely out of control, right? Like, I put it in kind of potentially overly blunt terms earlier today in thinking to myself, just Jeff Probst has lost his fucking mind with some of the stuff that they've been throwing out there.
Yeah, and I don't know. I would like to be a fly on the wall in the production compound when these decisions are being made. I don't know if this is Jeff having a clear vision for what he wants to do and imposing that upon the entire show, or if there's a more, to quote Gavin, whether there's a democracy or a dictatorship there. I don't know how that decision-making process goes down.
The big question I have is, and I think this would tell us a lot, what level is Jeff Probst on, and just the producers in general, what level are they on in general with those giant Boston Rob and Sandra heads? Are they like, I genuinely think that they may be saying, this is so cool. Like Jeff described it as the Mount Rushmore of Survivor. And I think those giant carved heads may be what he's talking about of like, I think he may view that as like an awesome, honor, an homage to these two titans of the game that they should be so flattered by.
With a sheer childlike enthusiasm for it. Yeah. And to be fair, they do look pretty cool. And if you're going to do this, at least commentate it properly.
They do not look cool.
Okay, agree to disagree on that one.
I mean, I think the Fiji Skull Exile Island structure looks really cool. I think a lot of the Ghost Island looked really cool. A lot of the Exile Islands have looked cool, where they can absolutely get away the pirate ship or whatever on Pearl Islands. Or some season had a pirate ship. This one had a ship and a mast sticking out, and that looked cool.
Right, but, and you have China, the whole environment there was a great example too.
All awesome. These giant paper mache heads, get the fuck out of here.
Even as recently as, I think it was Ghost Island, we were talking about how incredible the tribal council set looked, and some would argue that was one of the few redeeming features of whatever season that was, but we do seem to have declined aesthetically, and not in like a snobbish sense, but just we've gone from that to giant totems of Boston Rob's head. That feels like it's representative of some kind of shift in the show.
It's weird being in modern times as a Survivor fan, and now that you've mentioned it a couple times over this podcast, I'm really just terrified to think about what season 52 is even theoretically going to look like. It's crossed my mind many times over the last year or so. Remember when we used to think of millennials versus Gen X as a weird theme and like trying obviously way too hard? I would kill to go back to those days of these forced weird casts versus all of the just nonsense that gets thrown in now.
Yeah, it felt like much simpler times, which we'll never be able to go back to again. And even just listening back to that now, those discussions, it's going to feel so absolutely jarring that once registered with us as weird or some kind of oddity.
Right. I mean, we would mercilessly mock the title Worlds Apart, and now we're getting Heroes, Healers, Hustlers, and Ghost Island, and David versus Goliath, and Edge of Extinction, and Island of Idols, and it's just like, these are season themes that people would have put as jokes about, like, Armageddon timeline season themes they would fear for a few years from now.
Yeah, these are the Brant Steele simulations of Survivor season names.
Yeah. So let's get into Final Four here now. We get a pretty cool, honestly, seahorse looking kind of balance and finesse challenge where people walk back and forth really slowly. Otherwise, they'll knock their blocks over and spell out Final Three. And Chris completes the deal. He closes the deal, I guess would be the more conventional way of framing that. Wins the Final Four immunity challenge, locks his place in the finals. Or does he, Dominic, where we go on to see Chris, while he's helping the other two with fire, decide ultimately, I want to do this fire myself. I'm really comfortable in that department. And more to the point, I want to put on the best possible show for the jury. So he is going to give up the necklace so that he can be the one to take Rick Devens down in fire. What did you think about this enormous move here, Dom?
I was stunned and I absolutely loved it, because there's no way this can't end well. Either he gives up that shot, and you could say he would have lost to Rick if they both make the finals anyway, so he had to do this, but in terms of the way they surely would have framed it, either he gives up the necklace and loses and looks like an idiot, or he makes the biggest move conceivable in that situation and takes down Rick and essentially wins both halves of that Final Four challenge round.
Right. I think, first of all, huge kudos to Chris for being able to, for being willing to do this, I should say. I am guessing this is something everyone was talking about on Edge of Extinction is the idea of whoever goes back in should strongly consider the possibility of giving up the necklace. I don't know that that's the case, but it would not surprise me at all if that is something a lot of people had been throwing out there, and Chris potentially knew that this would be a big time crowd pleaser. But either way, very impressed with Chris and his willingness to do this. Obviously, it is contingent upon being very good in Fire, but any thinking player would have Fire with Flint mastered before showing up to LAX to fly out. So job well done by Chris there. And I was both surprised and very impressed with Chris and his willingness to do it. But that moment, Dom, where Chris's rope snaps, as you set up at the very beginning of this podcast, sincerely for me, was the biggest blindside in 38 seasons as a Survivor fan. I have never been more surprised than Rick Devens losing that competition. I was blown away.
And I for one loved it. And that's not because I was really cheering on for Rick to lose or because I had any vested interest whatsoever in Chris winning. I just, the fact that it subverted expectations so heavily was so great to see. And this was despite being like semi-spoiled by a comment that I saw on Twitter, which was not encouraging. So to have that veil like partially ripped away was not great. But despite all of that, this was just such an amazing thing to watch unfold in real time. And to see people's reactions who all assumed, because we all did, that of course Rick is going to win. And of course this is a done deal. And the only question is, what is the margin of his victory, or who is he going to be up there with, or how excruciating is this going to be? And for all of those assumptions to come crashing down in that single moment was absolutely amazing to watch. And for as much as I hate all of the things that made that moment possible and everything on the season leading up to the moment that made it possible, that was pretty good, I gotta say. Like, that's one thing that I will remember when all of this is said and done. That will be one of the things on the highlight reel, for sure.
Yeah, the only other real candidate that I can think of from the last few years was Wu taking Tony to the finals. Completely blew me away. I remember watching the Cagayan finale, and a friend of mine was over who was also a casual Survivor fan, and he was ready to head into the other room so we could go play some backgammon. And I was like, oh, just hang on. Let me just make sure Wu ends up taking Cass, and we can just, obviously Wu's going to win, and we'll just skip Final Tribal Council and go back to our degenerate gambling. And when that vote came in for Cass to be eliminated, my jaw hit the ground. And that's the only thing that I remember, I think, in the entire time we've been podcasting, at the very least, that has surprised me to this extent.
And that was a solid 5 years ago at this point. So in Survivor chronology, we're in maybe a different era now of the show.
Yeah.
I think it's going to be hard to top this, frankly. I mean, season 40, I think, is going to make a good run at it. It's going to make a valiant effort, but it's going to be hard to dislodge this purely in terms of how surprising it is. In terms of purity or integrity or other metrics that you might think are important, there's a conversation to be had there. But in terms of just sheer, like, joy, as you say, jaws hitting the floor, I don't see how anything really challenges that.
Right, because not only is it this guy swooping in out of nowhere, the stakes couldn't be any higher, and our expectations for Rick couldn't be any higher. Any time in the future that I say it's the biggest blindside of my life in Survivor, remind me of this moment.
Yeah, that quote will also have an asterisk by it, referring to this.
Yeah.
But going back to what you said about the increasing escalation of those expectations around Tribal Council performance and so on, do you think that something similar could occur here, where I saw various people credit Dominic Abate for this idea of giving up the necklace to go into Fire voluntarily? And I don't think that he or anyone else really owns that idea. It's just an obvious thing to consider when
I own it. I brought it up in our Ghost Island finale podcast. Dominic was doing all the exit press saying he should have thrown the challenge, and my answer was no, win the necklace and give it away and win the Fire yourself.
Okay, well, I giving credit where it's due, i.e. to anyone who has considered the possibility before. Various people were considering that, and that's just a natural thing to look at when the idea comes up. But I know Dominic has said that that's something he maybe should have pulled the trigger on if he felt that if he realized how close this final matchup truly was going to be. And I wonder now if this is going to become the new default expectation, where if you win that necklace and you don't consider giving it up to beat the person who may be your toughest opponent, that in itself will be seen as some act of cowardice.
Or just cockiness of like, oh, that guy thinks he could just win an immunity to get through to the end.
Right, he's trying to coast. He only wants to take part in one of the two halves of this cycle now.
Right. Oh, he's so confident that he doesn't even need to make fire to close out this social political game.
Right.
Yeah. I think you're right. I think we are absolutely in store for, assuming the fire challenge remains a thing, every future season having players very aware of the upside of doing this sort of thing.
As they should be, I would say.
Completely. Yeah. I mean, we could, again, have an entire different conversation about whether this sort of thing should be in play in the first place. But yeah, I think certainly the biggest spectacle one could pull off is winning the necklace, giving it away, and winning the fire. And I think that's essentially what it came down to for Chris, not just this round, but every single round. If we go through it, he won a necklace, he had an idol played on him, he played an idol for himself, he gave up the final immunity to take down the big bad of the season, and I think this is really why Chris won. And I want to give certainly credit where it's due to Hannah Shapiro, who did an amazing job on the live, or on the Know It Alls episode right after the finale aired live, where honestly, there's no real point in the two of us even being here right now. I'm not even kidding when I say 7 minutes after this episode finished airing, Hannah put it perfectly and explained exactly why the jury ended up rewarding Chris. And I meant to listen back to that and write it down. I genuinely listened to that entire episode twice because she was so good. And I meant to write the exact quote down. But the general idea was Chris was rewarded because every single juror was saying to themselves, Edge of Extinction, of course it's a valid part of this season. That's the way the game evolves. And if I had gone back in and done even half of what Chris has done, I should win, of course. So absolutely, Chris deserves my jury vote. And it is really the Ricks and Auroras and Laurens who spent so little time on Edge of Extinction and don't really value that journey through the game who were voting for Gavin.
I thought Gabby has stolen your heart, so it's good to see that it still belongs to Hannah. But yeah, I think when any one of those people who voted for Chris votes for Chris, not to align them all together, but a lot of them are voting essentially for themselves by proxy.
Right.
It's in the legitimacy of the possibility of them doing what Chris did and the hope that they themselves could have done what Chris did, even if realistically they would have fallen at one of the hurdles along the way there.
To me, I really don't ever feel comfortable telling juries how they should vote or whatever, but that was my overwhelming takeaway from the way this went down is the jury votes are so easily explained just by narcissism, by Chris being the person they wished they could have been in this game.
And it's easy for some of them to write that off as, well, Chris had to play the game too. There was this whole social game going on Edge of Extinction and so on. And I don't think even they truly believe that, but it just doesn't really stand up to any scrutiny because if when you're on the Edge of Extinction, there's no politicking that takes place. I'm sure there are some debates around how the food's going to be broken up or who has to do what. And inevitably, when you get a bunch of people together under those conditions, then there are going to be arguments and fights and talking behind each other's backs and so on, but nothing compared to the actual social game that Survivor is.
Right.
And it's like, when you're out there with that length of time, again, under those circumstances, which the other side of that coin is, because it's so tough, because it's so difficult, it's easier to bond. You have something to bond over, and going through that shared experience is going to make you much closer. You have to be this actively abrasive asshole not to be popular on the Edge of Extinction. You have to be going out there and trying to be Reem, basically, to not win people over out there. So it's easy to say that they were rooting for Chris because Chris is such a great guy and so on, but even if he wasn't, even if he was just this perfectly just bland, average, just nondescript human being, that he still would have had this large following behind him, because that's of course what's going to happen when you have the Edge of Extinction in place. That's the entire point, right? That it has this formative bonding experience.
Aubrey is the one who stands out from the episode talking at Final Tribal Council about saying in very confident terms, it seemed to me, as if she was trying to convince herself, something to the effect of, oh, that social political game was constant out there on Edge of Extinction. Oh, don't you undersell what was all the scheming that was going on out there. And furthermore, I remember hearing Ron in his like finale night red carpet interview with Rob talk about why he voted for Chris. And he literally said, oh, Chris was playing the game just as hard out on Edge of Extinction. I mean, he had to stay nice with people, and he was bringing in fish and chopping coconuts and making the fire, and he was doing everything. And again, to tie it back to Hannah, I thought she put it perfectly in saying something to the effect of Gavin and Julie had to keep people liking them while navigating this complicated social political game that is like ripe with cutthroatness and backstabbing, and Chris just had to keep people liking him. Sorry for stumbling through that paraphrasing, but that is such a massive distinction where it really is, as you were saying, a borderline free roll to just be nice to people out on Edge of Extinction. Of course, that's what you would do. Whereas in the game, there are actual, there's an element of trust that is a major factor, and people know that you can't possibly want to go to the end with all of them, and that you have to be lying to someone, where that element is just not at all in play on the Edge of Extinction. And to tie it back into what we were saying earlier, to me, it really just comes down to the jurors trying to validate their own experience and feel like they weren't wasting their time out there on the Edge of Extinction. And if Chris wasn't wasting his time being out of the game for 28 days, then my experience is all the more valid. And meanwhile, Gavin and Julie have no real choice but to make the argument, yeah, he was out of the game, but with this group of jurors, as in, like, he wasn't in here voting people out. He was just collecting food and making fires. And with this group of jurors, that's going to be received almost like a personal attack on them, of like what they were doing was wasting their time.
I'm not surprised by Aubrey's vote, because thinking back to that debate between her and Brent on RHAP over the season 35 finale with Ben and Chrissy, she was very pro Ben, and she seems to believe, she shares this view that just hard work in the game, whether that's defined as winning challenges or finding advantages or hustling, however you define that, that is a thing that should be rewarded. And that is, and whether you want to psychologically trace that back to the manner in which she lost, where the jury claimed that they didn't recognize her gameplay or whatever, I'm sure you can debate how much of that goes into it, but I'm not surprised to see her say that. Was there anyone whose vote did surprise you? Someone who you thought would be categorically opposed to someone who came back from the edge being handed the win? Or, you know, does that mindset just infect all of them while they're out there?
David Wright is the one who really stood out to me.
Yeah, see, with David, I think he was so prepared to vote for Rick. Like, for as much as Rick was his best friend out there, his closest ally and so on, I don't think he was going to take some principled stand out there on behalf of Gavin, right? Like in that case. And so when we get the same final three, except suddenly, shocking twist, Rick is now replaced with Chris, it's very easy to just continue that mindset, I would say.
Rick spent 3 days out of the game. Chris spent 28 days out of the game.
Okay, well, so for you then, is this just a question of degree? Is there some, there doesn't need to be an exact threshold, but are there circumstances under which you would entertain voting for someone who was voted out and returned by some kind of mechanism?
Yeah, I mean, when it happened, when Rick re-entered in the merge, I said, oh, this is easily the best case scenario in terms of someone I could see myself talking a jury vote into, you know, talking myself into a jury vote for. where they're out for one round because they swapped poorly, and then they're in there for the entire individual phase. I certainly don't have an exact number of like, oh, if you are out for more than 7 days, you're drawing dead for me. But anything less than that, you're in. It is totally case by case, but there is no, and I mean zero chance that I could ever vote for someone who was out for 28 days. As my, again, to tie it back to nothing against Chris at all, good for Chris. There is no one in the world that I would vote for having spent 28 days on Edge of Extinction. That is not even close to playing a game of Survivor, as far as I'm concerned.
Looking at the Wikipedia voting history for the season is a wild ride, because you have the usual like reverse pyramid or whatever, as you go up the boot order, and then with Chris at the top, it's the first three votes, on which of course the last one of those he's getting voted out, so he doesn't vote correctly, and then this gigantic gap for the entirety of like the rest of the row, and then finally we get to Victoria, Lauren, Rick, and then it's and then he's crowned the winner. It's just it really hits home just how much of the entire game, the entire process, he was absent for. And for as much as he said in his confessional, which I'm sure he has to, because they're all prompted to say something about outwitting and outplaying and outlasting, he said something about how he had outlasted better than anyone, and it's like, no, you've outlasted literally less than anybody yeah. out there in the game. There is no, even the people who maybe you don't respect, if you are not inclined to give credit to someone like Julie, she has at least literally outlasted longer than you have. Everyone out there has outlasted longer than you have. It's kind of to like when in the Game of Thrones finale, when Tyrion,
spoilers,
like,
careful,
when Tyrion says, who has a better story than Bran, and the answer is everyone standing right here for a start. Like it's basically the same thing. It's like everyone has outlasted better than Chris admittedly put on a good show for the last few tribal councils and did play pretty well there, but he's playing with a hand which has been decided for him by everyone on Edge of Extinction, furnishing him with that information and everything that he needs to go in there. And it's got to be easier to play that way as well, knowing that you're guaranteed to win if you make it there, unless it's against Rick. And so all of these decisions, which seem like such big bold gambits, which they are, not to take it away from him, but he doesn't really have another choice, right? A lot of this is predetermined for him.
The other thing that I really take issue with that Gavin brought up at Final Tribal Council, but I feel like hasn't really resonated with enough people to this point, is Chris would have been voted out yet again at Final 6, or at Final 5, had he not been handed an idol by production. It's not like he even found that idol. It was just given to him. And yes, you can make the case of like, oh, we had to get Rick to give him his other half back. But I think that makes total sense in Rick's spot. And I think that's something the producers easily could have anticipated when they put that idol in Chris's bag to begin with, that dynamic being in play. And that really doesn't sit well with me. Again, like, to give Chris points for successfully using an idol in a spot that was handed to him in a spot where he would have otherwise been voted out does not really ring true for me, I suppose, as a juror.
It doesn't compute.
Yeah, exactly. I think that is a massive, massive mark against Chris that I would, you know, if I were somehow able to overlook the 28 days away from the game, that would be another hard, hard point in not, you know, in one of the other two's favors there. And I guess let's get into this Final Tribal Council, the specifics of that. And I did want to note for the record that Jeff even goes through the charade this season of opening with the quote about the power is now in the hands of the jury, the same people you voted out either directly or indirectly, as Chris is sitting right there about to win.
Yeah, fire represents your life. And Chris, if you want to just dip your torch in the fire there, that would be great. All of the accoutrements of the show that we take for granted have to be reevaluated in the light of someone just skipping an entire month's worth of gameplay and then being smuggled in at the very end.
Yeah, the other Jeff note I had from Final Tribal Council that I very much hated, and I think shows you all you really need to see about the production motivation, is when they, you know, Jeff weaves them through Outwit, Outplay, Outlast over the course of Final Tribal Council. When he gets to the Outplay, he says, "Let's get to Outplay. You had to deal with idols and twists and advantages. Edge of Extinction was a big part of Outplay this season. Who wants to get us started?" Like, Edge of Extinction is where you're outplaying people on this season?
It's, yeah, I would happily go back to the old jury format, if only so I never have to hear the words Outwit, Outplay, and Outlast outside of the show's tagline again.
Right. I know this is not news. I think we've been very much on the record about this since it began in, like, Game Changers of Jeff and his new role during Final Tribal Council, but could not be harder out on all of that. I do love the roundtable element and people being able to ask more than one question, potentially staggered over the course of a couple hours or whatever, and ask follows up to other people's questions, but very much not interested in Jeff getting his grubby little paws all over this thing any more than he already does. Dom, I had set the line in our finale preview podcast. I had a feeling this may take a little while to get through Final Tribal Council, and they've been creeping further and further into the reunion time season after season. I set the line at 10:24 p.m. being the time that the final vote for the winner would be read. It ended up coming in at 10:27 p.m., so anyone on the over, go ahead and cash those tickets. What do you have from Final Tribal Council?
I really have nothing, right? Like, there was no crowning moment. There was no big clash of philosophies, I guess, over you have Chris, who by any conventional survivor logic should not be here, and now that he is, I don't know how I'm meant to evaluate him, versus Gavin, who played a fairly by the books under the radar game, who we're gonna have to try and tease the details out of him and see how much of that was just him actually consciously doing that versus choosing to hide away from the spotlight. So there was no, like, I expected this to be, if anything, like, more incendiary than it was, but instead it felt like a done deal. By the moment we saw the fire cut through Rick's rope, we knew what the outcome was going to be, and the only question was how many votes was Gavin or Julie going to be able to claw away from him.
Right. I'm sure the first time around I was barely even watching Final Tribal Council because I was watching Twitter melt down, myself very much included, instead, and my only notes from my rewatch on Final Tribal Council are Final Tribal Council thoughts, question mark, and never followed those up with anything substantial.
I couldn't even steal your thoughts because you didn't have any either.
I know. So I've really outthought the game here, Dom. I would say an overall solid job by Chris in his position, but I thought Gavin put in a valiant enough effort given what he was up against, to say the least, and I really came away from Final Tribal Council feeling bad for him. It seemed like maybe this is just my bias as, like, what I value in the game or how I would consider myself as a hypothetical juror, but it really seemed like Gavin was making a lot of extremely compelling points that were totally falling on deaf ears.
Yeah, and it has to be so demoralizing going in there knowing that you're not facing an impartial panel, right? These are people who have this vested rooting interest and have done and have made it clear at Tribal, and you're just going up against this brick wall, and there's really nothing you can do about it except try to salvage as many votes as you can.
Right. I think it's very telling, and I'm happy to chalk many jury votes up to coincidence over the years. This, to me, is not a coincidence that the people who voted for Gavin were Devins, Lauren, Aurora, and Wentworth, and the people who voted for Chris were the people who spent the most time with Chris and on Edge of Extinction themselves.
Exactly, yeah. And I do wonder if, again, Gavin was saved from being defeated in a conventional way, which, like, if that happens, no one would be arguing, I think, that, oh, well, Gavin deserved to win, Gavin was robbed, the whole jury system needs an overhaul. Whereas now he gets to maybe hide partially behind that, where the fact that Chris is there in the first place obscures the fact that Gavin was still going to lose, but maybe just to a different set of people.
Yeah, I don't know what more Gavin could have done, honestly, in this situation. and I view him as kind of a spiritual successor to Devin Pinto, just having a game of Survivor taken away from him because he was far less interesting than the underdog.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And so without anything really substantial on Final Tribal Council, Chris is our winner of Survivor Edge of Extinction. Everyone goes wild. What do you think, Dom, about now that we have this person who has spent 28 days on the edge, come back in, played a really solid final 4 or 5 days in there, go on to win Survivor? What has changed for you in terms of how you view this game compared to how you did 2 weeks ago?
I don't think anything has really changed. It's just confirming what I was worried about the whole time, that if you want a moment to represent that shift in what the game is about now and what it represents, this is it. I don't think you can find any better way of encapsulating the change in Survivor from, let's say, the first Chris winning back in season 9 to this Chris winning here almost 30 seasons later. It's such a perfect example of that if you're making the Survivor time capsule again in 10 years, this is a moment that goes in it. That Chris just being announced as a winner of Survivor, or just being eligible to be announced as a winner of Survivor, that really hits a home for me.
Yeah, I look forward to those days in the future that we talked about a little earlier where we can think back on this season and remember finale night and what a blindside it was when this dude just parachutes in and takes it all home. Right now, my just overwhelming takeaway on Edge of Extinction as a season and just the state of modern Survivor is I really can't get over just how much help was they attempted to give to Rick Devens. And I've spent so many years trying to be super generous with benefit of the doubt and not screaming about it on too many podcasts, but turning a blind eye and suspending disbelief and all the things that I could do to talk myself into there being some shred of decency on the production angle here. Honestly, after another season of guy can't find an idol until he's the scrappy underdog, at which point he's just auto safe for every round, and the seeming glee that they take in that and the regret that they have that didn't work out is to me just the ultimate indicator that I can no longer keep pretending and lying to myself. All bets are off. We are officially in Big Brother land. I have spent many hours. I've opened the last 3 or 4 season in review podcasts with monologues about how terrified I am that we would reach this point. Here we are. I genuinely don't know how I can go on caring about what really happens on a season of Survivor.
I think what you do is you take Survivor down from its pedestal and you admit it resembles the show that we once idolized as something more than maybe it ever was. And now it's just a fun show that has the same premise as one that we used to, exalt more than everything else. But it's just a fun show that we can analyze and overanalyze and then overanalyze over and over again. But it's, it doesn't need to be something that's like on a different plane of integrity than the challenge, right? It's just a show that's fun. And we come in here and we talk about it and we talk with our friends about it and we make more friends by talking to them about it. And that's all well and good. But there's no kind of added dimension that maybe we like to think there used to be.
Right. I've spent 7 or 8 years trying to maintain that image of Survivor as better than The Challenge and Big Brother. And I am officially at the point, certainly after this most recent season of The Challenge, where The Challenge is better than Survivor. There's no question about it in my mind. And I'm hoping the all-winner season can change that. But there's zero doubt that I am looking far more forward to the next season of The Challenge than I am for season 39.
And The Challenge is much more upfront about what it tries to be as well. It doesn't claim to have this higher status that then it very quickly proves it doesn't have. It just is what it is and admits that, and that's kind of refreshing in this day and age.
Right.
I will say as well, I've changed my tune a little bit on one thing, and that's that I want to see Chris on season 40. I think logistically it could have worked with the filming dates and everything, because I believe that they went straight from the season 38 finale to flying people out there. So it would be fun to see Chris get his $1 million check and then just get on a plane again to head back to Fiji. But on a season like that, where it's full of these all-stars, I like there being one or two wild cards in the mix, these unknown quantities. So for Heroes vs. Villains, you had Russell Hanson there, who by himself was a big ticket item. He was a big draw to that season. But for the people out there, they didn't know anything about him because he was on the preceding season, and the filming dates worked out such that none of them, with the possible exception of Parvati, depending on who you believe, had any idea who he was. This time around, Chris is a known quantity insofar as he was on the season, and I guess some people maybe knew his name for some parts of that, but he's unknown insofar as we didn't get to see him play Survivor for, as you said, 28 days. So we saw the beginning of his game, and we saw the end of his, I guess, his second game, but we didn't see the part in between. And that would be a fun thing to see if he can elevate, if he can rise to the challenge of an all-winner season where he's essentially playing Survivor for the first time. I think that would be a more compelling storyline than just having Nick Wilson out there again for some reason.
So we don't need to get in a whole debate about this. I strongly disagree. I've always hated having one unknown person have an enormous advantage in a field of otherwise people who all know what the others are capable of. Yes, Russell was very entertaining in Heroes versus Villains, but I would always rather have even footing in terms of everyone knows everyone or no one knows anyone.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So I was very much on board with the plan to not have Chris on the all winners season. I give me Nick Wilson over Chris, as crazy as that may sound. So there we have it, Dom. Chris is, whether we like it or not. And again, I'm really not trying to take anything away from Chris himself. It's just the person missing 28 days on Edge of Extinction is a little tough to swallow, at least at this point in time.
It is a really fun storyline to think about, that Chris goes out there as this massive superfan who was dropping references left and right in his preseason stuff, who was very heavily invested in playing the type of game that he wanted to play, the perfect game that he alluded to when he was on the Edge of Extinction. He gets out there, he gets voted out very soon under these bizarre circumstances, possibly due to a mistake of his own doing. And then as he's walking out, defeated, crushed, he learns that he's about to have this new lease of life in the game, goes to Edge of Extinction, the first Edge of Extinction return challenge, he loses, he thinks that his journey's over again, only to learn that he's going back there, and then a few weeks later he comes back, he wins a second one, gets this new lease on life, is able to blaze his way through the game in impressive fashion to the finals, where he wins, and now suddenly, after canning himself out of the game at least twice, he now is announced as the one of the most interesting, we'll go with that, winners of all time. And that's just got to be one of the just most bizarre journeys that any winner has had. Even the ones who, like, you think back to, like, the Dannys or the Chris Doherty's or the people who thought they were out for the count within the usual confines of the game of Survivor and then came back to win. Chris has had a weirder journey than maybe any of them. So I don't know if he's going to pay attention to any of the online debates that were raging about his win. I think he'll take his $1 million and disappear and be quite happy about it. Just in real time, that must have been such a bizarre thing to go through.
This is by far the weirdest journey that any winner has ever had. I mean, Chris, let's bear in mind, is a super fan who found himself voted out on day 8 and then, through finding himself on the right season, was able to hang out on the beach for another month or so and then plop back into the game at Final 6 and win. I would guess that every moment of that was beyond surreal. The idea, you know, just showing up and seeing the sign after being voted out and thinking his dreams have been smashed has got to be, you know, that's something a lot of people went through, but that by itself has got to be crazy. And then to spend genuinely close to a full month, if this was shot in the month of February, on the Edge of Extinction, and then get back in and win after playing essentially 5 days near the end game, I cannot imagine that even today this feels completely real to Chris.
Right. If I was Chris, I would just be compulsively checking my bank account to make sure this wasn't some weird fever dream that I'm about to wake up from.
Yeah. Likewise. I mean, this is impossible. This could never happen.
Yeah, and yet here we are, Colin.
Right, it's unbelievable. But yeah, here we are is right. So let's, I think, hit a little from the reunion. I don't have a ton here other than Devins gets $100,000 from Sia, who I'm pretty sure had been giving like $15,000 to Davey and Donathan and Ty and so forth. I was wondering, Jeff seemed to frame it as this is the new thing. This is the Sia prize. It's $100,000. I personally would be pretty surprised if it continued to be $100,000. I believe that Sia will keep giving people money, but the $100,000 really seems specific to Rick, right?
I guess so. Maybe someone's getting $1 million next. Maybe that's the new prize that everyone should be playing for.
That's what it should be. Is she should give $2 million to her favorite from the next season, and then suddenly this primetime game show on network TV becomes all about pleasing Sia.
That is definitely worth playing for. Yeah, so I think you have to, yeah, that's how you have to focus it at that point, right?
Yeah. Joe, as I think we touched on a little earlier, gets $15,000 to charity for cutting his hair. Did you see the picture of short hair Joe?
I did not. Am I missing out?
Dreamboat.
Okay, does he have like this like Eminem style buzz cut or what's going on?
No,
here?
He has more of a, I don't even know what you would call, he still has plenty of hair on the top of his head. I think he would do himself a favor now that he has that short hair to do some substantial trimming on that mustache, but otherwise still hard to argue with what Joe's looking like.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So I did want to ask a little bit about your thoughts on just the overall edit of this season. Obviously a tremendously weird circumstance, but what did you think of what they did with the episodes full of people that ultimately didn't end up mattering too much come finale night? But any major takeaways from you in terms of good things or bad things from this season in the edit?
Mostly bad things, I would say. I think they put themselves into a tough spot with this concept just existing and didn't do much to try and get themselves out of it. I think they gave themselves a poor hand and then played it poorly as well.
Yeah, they certainly gave themselves a poor hand. There's no doubt about that. I really wish we would have gotten to see more specifically out of a lot of those comma people. I think we would have been really well served to see more from Victoria in particular. Lauren, I guess, wasn't an original comma person, but she also seemed really underserved. And I'm guessing Gavin had at least slightly more to say than we ended up getting to see out there. Ron and Julie seemed like they could have been a little more fun than negative for the most part. But overall, I enjoyed the episodes for sure on a week-to-week basis. It's just weird knowing that none of it ultimately matters, and maybe that is why they were able to have so much fun in a lot of the weeks in terms of really unpredictable votes, is knowing the long-term story arc is neither here nor there.
Yeah, and I think there's a lot that you can do when you adopt that mindset, but it felt like they didn't take that many adventures with it, and instead we kind of got the worst that opens up and not the best, if that makes sense.
Yeah, the one thing I did really like in terms of editing is we are seeing more and more of the flashbacks. I will reiterate once again, time
no.
manipulation. What?
That has never been tried on any.
No, I'm not saying. Okay,
before.
God damn it! I'm not even saying that. I'm saying, like, this is what I'm saying is time manipulation is the future of this show if they want to go that route. There is so much that could be done to make Survivor way more exciting if they're willing to use flashbacks more liberally.
Do it to me. Confuse me every episode. Trick me. Bamboozle me. Whatever you feel like you have to do. Make me feel like an idiot. Make me feel like I should have seen this coming the whole time. I want to be slack-jawed as I'm watching myself get blindsided by something that I thought was innocuous 30 minutes ago, right? Like, if you're going to go into this carnival phase of Survivor, just embrace it. Just go off the rails.
It's not going off the rails. It's doing something really smart for once. And it is, again, just if they ever decide that they want to go that route, that will be the future of the show, is using time manipulation to make the stories more dramatic. Dom, Edge of Extinction overall, where is this for you in the grand scheme of Survivor seasons?
So, in the same way that it's hard to evaluate Chris compared to anyone else with all of the asterisks floating around everywhere. I would say that there are seasons which I enjoyed watching this week to week more than I enjoyed watching those other seasons. Like Worlds Apart comes to mind. There are a few others I'm sure I could conjure up as well. But just in terms of what this means for the franchise and this in the bigger picture, it's hard for me to say with a clear conscience that it's better than any of those others.
Right. I definitely enjoyed it on a week-to-week basis more than plenty of other, or at least a few other seasons. I would be very surprised if I find myself rewatching this anytime in the next 5 years. So it's going to take me feeling like I've forgotten pretty much everything from this season for me to feel inspired to go back and check it out again.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So I'm not going to call it anything close to conclusively the worst season of all time or anything like that, but it will forever be in the mix for me there. And I guess we should actually talk quickly about, now that the bottom of the list has come up, Chris in the winner rankings, is he even rankable?
I don't know, honestly, and I'm not inclined to try and find an excuse to rank him. It is not an appealing intellectual exercise for me, really. So I'm just gonna not take a stance on that question, I guess.
Yeah, I will have Ben will be still at the bottom of my list with his asterisk, and Chris, I think, will have the double asterisk, where it's a slightly different technicality, but also just not someone that I can even begin to evaluate compared to any other winner.
Would you say, with the gameplay that Chris had to and tried to cram into those last few days, that he's shown that aptitude for the game that would have you, you know, pleased about his prospects going into a random season, or is it just too hard to say?
Definitely would be pleased about his prospects going into a random season if he wasn't such a jacked guy. I think him being an imposing physical threat is going to get in his way an enormous percentage of the time when he's not spending 28 days on the edge of extinction. But in terms of his mind for the game and his ability to implement his ideas and get on people's good side, yeah, it seems like I would at this point have no reason not to feel great about Chris as a general Survivor player.
Yeah, it's hard for me to say, because Chris, my initial impression of him was he was so just unstanding out from the crowd. I'm sure there's an adjective for that I guess so. Like we joked initially about, oh, of course Chris is going to be the one to come back. That would be by far the least exciting outcome, right? And this was before Rick came back for the first Edge of Extinction challenge. And then I never imagined that Chris could wow us the way that he did when he came back for the second time. So maybe I'm giving him too little credit. Maybe beneath that unremarkable exterior, there is actually a fire burning there.
Well, to tie this back into the edit of the season, maybe the big takeaway is, as usual, we need to be paying more attention to the casuals, because casual Anna was all over Chris, even when he was getting no confessionals and he was off on the edge of extinction. She was saying, hey, Chris is my favorite. Chris is my favorite. So I think maybe some more weight needs to be placed there.
Even a broken casual Anna is right twice a day.
Yeah. So there we go, Dom. Edge of Extinction is in the books, and we can move swiftly on, hopefully, to Island of Idols, which I never thought is something I would want to move swiftly on to, but here we are nonetheless.
I don't want to move swiftly on. I want to detox for a little bit. I want to take a breather. I want to mentally steel myself for what's in store here. I don't want to rush into this.
Yeah, we talked already about the very cool giant statues of Rob and Sandra out on the Season 39 set. I loved seeing Rob already plugging his book in the promo here. I'm going to set the line at like over under 3.5 plugs for the Boston Rob rule book over the duration of season 39, and probably at least another 3.5 over the duration of season 40 as well. Are you excited to have Rob and Sandra back, Dom?
Yeah, sure. Why not?
Do you think they might get jury votes is a question I've seen come up a few different places.
Oh, that's an interesting thing to try and like set the odds for, right? Is, well, what is the chance that one of the two of them receives a jury vote on this season?
I mean, both are gonna. I don't think it's ever gonna just be one of them. I would guess it's either two or zero.
How do you mean?
it seems like they're both going to be serving in identical roles the entire game, so how could only one of them ever get a jury vote?
Well, if they enter the game, like BB14 style, and then one of them gets voted out, the other one makes it to the end.
They will be entering the game once the jury has started, Dom. These producers aren't idiots. They're not going to open the door for them to not be there the whole time. I do not believe that they will enter the game, but if they did, okay, it would be late enough for the jury.
I have no idea why you're asking that, because it seems pretty straightforward to me, but what I'm saying seems to be baffling.
I'm saying Rob and Sandra, as far as I'm concerned, will remain mentors the entire time and may get jury votes at the end of that. Or they may get entered, in which case the jury already will have started and they will both get jury votes. There is no scenario, as far as I can see, where only one of them gets a jury vote.
Oh, I think that's close to a lock, right? I thought what you meant was, what are the odds that one of them receives a jury vote, which is maybe an interesting question too.
So you think they could potentially get plopped in as players?
Yeah, I think there will be a big red Boston Rob button, shake like his hat, you know, which they can use to enter the game at some point. I don't think that, I agree with you that they want them there for the duration, but I think that that's going to involve, when we get to the merge, the big twist is, now you have a decision to make. Do you want to join the game, or do you want to remain as a mentor in some capacity?
I am willing to bet on this if you would be so inclined, and maybe we can work it out off air. I think it is much more likely that they are not entered, and the reason is they both know, and production knows, you're out here because we want you here for next season. You're going to play next season, and right now you're just out in Fiji giving us what we want.
Okay, that does sound fair enough.
Yeah, so I would be quite surprised. Please bet me on that, but again, it certainly could happen that they get dropped in. Either way, I'm personally very much looking forward to Rob and Sandra getting to chime in on the goings-on of the main game. I'm just very nervous that it's going to be an oversaturation.
Yeah, and at this point, I'm expecting the worst and almost welcoming the worst. Like, do it to me, right? If I'm going to turn up and watch this show every season, then test the limits of that commitment, you know? So I want to learn that about myself, too.
It's weird that it's essentially, you know, we just rewatched Heroes versus Villains and did like 33 hours of podcasts on that season over on Patreon. And I have this flashback now to Rob and Sandra sitting on the beach on like day two, watching Coach climb the tree and like giving commentary about all that's happening on the villains camp. And that's essentially what I'm anticipating, is them just sitting on the beach, cracking wise about what's going on around them.
Yeah, and I don't know how much time is going to be devoted to Rob and Sandra, but both of them are good TV. So I'm honestly fine if we're taking a few minutes out of our day every week to check in with them and get a good soundbite there.
Yeah, all right. Dom, anything else from you?
No, it's all over, finally. Let's just get out of here. Let's put this to rest and put this behind us.
Yeah, we have, as I mentioned at the top of the show, a lot of Season 40 stuff already going on, and much more, I'm sure, coming shortly, both on this main feed and also over at patreon.com/DomandColin. Weekly bonus episodes up there for anyone interested in that and to help support the show. So that is going to wrap us up on Season 38. What number, let's see, we started with 23. So this is season number 16 for us in the books. Wow. If I did that math correctly, 15 and a half. I think we started at the merge in South Pacific.
Yeah. I was going to say, yeah.
Yeah, either way, they are piling up quickly, and I believe we will be back for season 39 unless we get canceled in the meantime, which is always a possibility. Until then, I am on Twitter at Colin Stone. He is on Twitter at DomHRV, and you can email the show domandcolin@gmail.com. Thanks for sticking with us all season long. I'm sure we will talk to you guys very soon. Take care, everybody. La Cheesery. All right, that doesn't work that well because Rick did not win, and this is the worst sign-off in season finale history. Goodbye.
You are canceled now.
I am awful. All right, this podcast, it's not canceled by the time 39 rolls around, some serious mistakes have been made. If it is still in existence, we will talk to you then. Take care, everybody.
Okay, bye. All right.
That was terrible. Fuck. All right.
Anyway, it's fine. We'll start trying together.